From NPR and WBUR, I'm Celeste Headlee in Washington, D.C.
I'm Robin Young in Boston. It's Here and Now. The Senate passed that sweeping climate bill over the weekend. We covered elsewhere on the show today. But right now, what's happening on the state level, where Republican state treasurers are stopping efforts to fight climate change? More than 10,000 pages of documents and emails reviewed by the New York Times show a coordinated effort to punish companies, block federal appointees, and fight regulations. David Gellis, a reporter on the climate desk at the New York Times, helmed the report. So, David, start right off. How are elected state treasurers punishing companies that support climate action, or ESG, it's called, environmental, social, and governance priorities?
Well, thanks for having me. And what's so remarkable is that after years of sort of talking and wringing their hands around companies' increasing involvement in some social and political issues, these Republican treasurers have found ways to hit back. And specifically, what they've done is at least three state treasurers have withdrawn upwards of $700 million out of the accounts managed by BlackRock, the world's biggest asset manager, which is very outspoken in its efforts to combat climate change. And then just last week, the treasurer of West Virginia banned five major financial institutions from doing business with his state because of their stance on environmental issues.
Riley Moore is the state treasurer of West Virginia. Some of those banks that are banned, Goldman Sachs, J.P. Morgan, Wells Fargo, barred from any government contracts. And then also states withdrawing huge amounts of their investments from BlackRock. What is one of the concerns with them doing that?
Well, for BlackRock, this represents a pretty small piece of their business. So it's not as if BlackRock's bottom line is going to suffer because a few states pull out even $1 billion. The bigger concern is that we're moving ever closer with every episode like this towards a country where Republicans are going to do business with one set of banks and Democrats are going to do business with a different set of banks. And everyone I talk to, when they really thought about that, acknowledge that that's not what we need in this country. That's just going to further polarize and increase the divisions that are already so present in so many aspects of our daily life.
Well, not just polarize, but maybe impoverish. I mean, Utah and Idaho, for instance, are criticizing plans by S&P Global. That's the ratings agency. They want to integrate climate risk, S&P does, into their ratings. If you cut off companies that are looking honestly at the impact of climate change, what do you do to pensions?
At a certain point, what we're talking about here, especially when the state treasurers are involved, is the financial health of the pension systems, the financial health of the investments that the states manage. Now, the companies managing these investments will say that it is imperative that they address the long-term risks of climate change, and that that means gradually weaning away from investments in fossil fuels and rapidly moving away from investments in coal. The states, however, that still have large industries supporting the fossil fuel business, they say, well, you're essentially boycotting our states. So if you're not going to do business with us, why should we give our business, why should we give our investments to you to manage?
Well, of course, others would say, why not move in the direction of these companies? Why not follow their lead, retrain your workers, find other ways to keep them in more sustainable energy? But putting that aside, who's behind this? Because this is a very coordinated effort. And there's a little-known nonprofit called the State Financial Officers Foundation. It's backed by conservative think tanks like the Heritage Foundation that they help link the foundation to state treasurers. What do you find out about this ecosystem?
This is one of the most sort of astonishing things I discovered when I reviewed 10,000 pages of emails and documents was the degree to which conservative think tanks with long-standing ties to groups like the Koch brothers and the oil industry were essentially had a direct line to these state treasurers and were giving them talking points about how they ought to think about everything from President Biden's nominations to key financial regulatory posts to new rules being proposed by the Department of Labor and the Securities and Exchange Commission. And then very rapidly seeing those same talking points appear in letters, in memos and public statements being made by the state treasurers as they opposed climate action around the country, in the business world, and in the federal government.
It's really quite a bit of reporting. David Gellis at the Climate Desk at the New York Times will link our listeners at hereandnow.org Do you see this, though, growing or just remaining with these hardcore state treasurers who don't believe in climate change?
It is the beginning of this effort, I'm afraid to say. Tennessee, Oklahoma, Texas, and West Virginia have already passed some of these laws that I described earlier that allow them to essentially stop doing business with companies that they claim are quote-unquote boycotting fossil fuels. There are dozens of states where these similar bills are making their way through the legislature. I expect many more to be passed in the months to come, and I think we're going to see more and more efforts by state treasurers and state attorneys generals to really punish directly the corporations that they say are placing undue emphasis on the environmental crisis that is impacting, you know, every one of us as we all swelter through this summer every single day.
David Gillis, thank you so much.
Thank you.
The abortion map has been redrawn again. Those are abortion rights supporters in Indiana protesting as the state legislature debated and then passed a ban on nearly all abortions last Friday. That makes Indiana the first state to pass new abortion restrictions after the Supreme Court struck down Roe v. Wade. Pharmaceutical company Eli Lilly and engine maker Cummins both condemned the law over the weekend. Those are two of the state's biggest employers. For more, we're joined by Indiana Public Broadcasting State House reporter Brandon Smith. Hi, Brandon. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks you for having me on.
So this law is basically a near total abortion ban. It was debated late into the night last Friday. Can you tell us what's in this?
Sure. As you pointed out, it is a near total abortion ban. Looking at the history of abortions performed in Indiana over the last several years, the estimate is that this would make 95 to 99% of them illegal. So the only abortions allowed would be abortions performed to save the life of the pregnant person or to prevent serious health risks. And then in cases of rape or incest, it would allow those up to 10 weeks post-fertilization, which is 12 weeks gestational age.
So not all Republicans in Indiana were on board. They did get enough votes to pass this law just a few days after Kansas voters overwhelmingly upheld that state's constitutional right to an abortion. Do you think the Kansas vote may be part of the reason some Republicans opposed this new law?
I honestly don't. There was a lot of mention of the Kansas vote in those last few days of debate, but I don't think it actually had that much of a difference because the dividing lines, even within the Republican caucuses, were already fairly clear, which is that there are a relatively smaller group of Republicans who felt like this law goes too far. It restricts abortions too much. But you had a larger group of Republicans who felt like the bill didn't go far enough. They had an amendment on the floor in both the House and the Senate to get rid of those rape and incest exceptions, and 39% of each chamber voted to eliminate those exceptions. So a sizable number, but clearly, again, not enough to make that change.
We mentioned that the companies Cummins and Eli Lilly were very swift to condemn this bill. What has been the response from the Indiana business community?
Swift to condemn it after it had already passed.
Yeah,
Eli Lilly and Cummins and some of the state's top employers were utterly silent through the two-week debate over this bill. And that has enraged, I think, would be a fair characterization for some abortion rights activists and advocates in the state of Indiana. I mean, this bill only passed the Senate the first time by a single vote. It passed the Senate for good this past Friday, sending it to the governor by only about three votes. So could Eli Lilly have coming out and saying, hey, we're going to have to look for opportunities elsewhere because of this law, could that have made a difference for a few Republicans? I don't know. Maybe not. But we'll never know now, because what is the point of sending out a statement after a law has taken effect to say, well, this does not match what we would like to see happen?
Well, after the law is passed, it takes effect on September 15th.
Yes.
And there have been reports that some doctors are hesitant to practice in states where there are abortion bans. Has there been a response from the medical community there?
Absolutely. IU Health, which is the state's largest hospital system, came out while the debate was going on and expressed issues with it, worrying about, can we recruit the workforce we need to supply healthcare in the state of Indiana, a state that already has severe healthcare worker shortages across a lot of counties. I mean, there are, during the testimony in the House committee, for instance, a fourth-year medical resident in Indiana came to testify against the bill and shared that they had done a survey of about 400 medical trainees across Indiana's healthcare system about this law. And 80% of the 400 surveyed said, I'm going to look elsewhere to practice if this becomes law. And it has become law. It'll take effect in about a month and a half, and we will see what the consequences are after that.
That's Brandon Smith, Indiana Public Broadcasting State House reporter. Brandon, thank you so much.
Thank you.
When Netflix's Bridgerton season 2 aired earlier this year, it swept the internet into a kind of frenzy that really only a juicy love story can. The show takes place in an alternate past, an imagined history in which people of color occupy positions of power within English nobility. It's been praised for its inclusive casting and depiction of interracial romance. But in reality, Bridgerton's source material features exclusively white main characters, as do the majority of historical romance novels. And new fans hoping to pick up a juicy romance novel might find themselves disappointed by the lack of representation within the plot lines. But there are authors of color writing historical romance about people of color, centering them and their experiences within the historical context of the story. So let's bring in two of those authors now. Beverly Jenkins is an acclaimed author known for her 19th century romances featuring black characters. Hi, Beverly.
How are you? Thanks for the invite.
And we're also joined by New York Times bestselling author Courtney Milan. Welcome.
Hi, thank you for having me on.
So something that we often hear when people talk about this lack of diversity in historical pieces is it wouldn't be historically accurate. I wonder what you make of that argument. I mean, understanding that people of color did exist in the 19th century and even further back. Let me start with you, Beverly. What do you make of this argument that they have to be historically accurate?
You know, I think the people who are demanding this historical accuracy consider themselves experts, and they're not. We existed. We had lives. We had adventures. We had love. And I think it pays a, it's a disservice to us, those of us who write characters of color, that we are considered historically inaccurate.
Courtney, let me get your views on this as well, because there are lots of anachronisms in any historical romance novels. Why do you think it's the racial demographics that seem to really bother people?
Well, you know, the first thing I want to point out is that the idea that historical romances have to be set in England is kind of weird to start off with, because I believe there was history in other countries as well. Bev, you can back me up on that.
What?
Yeah.
I know. Shocking, right? When you're talking about fiction, I'm not sure what the word inaccuracy means, except something along the lines of, I don't want to believe in this particular fiction that you have come up with.
Yeah.
It's because they don't want to recognize what has been in the past.
Yeah. And it's outside of their comfort zone to have to know that a lot of the, you know, quote unquote English stuff was all based on the sugar and the slaves. They want to read about that. So,
I mean, that's such an excellent point, because I think every historical romance contains the products of people of color. Tea.
Yeah.
They all drink tea. Where did that tea come from? Cotton.
Right.
Some of that cotton was produced in England, but a lot of it came from the slaveholding South. Rum, sugar, China, silk. Most of the things that we see in historical romances that they use as markers of people's wealth are actually trade goods that were produced by people of color.
So Beverly, you have been writing historical romance that featured Black characters and Black main characters since the 1990s, when there was even less representation in the genre. How difficult was it for you to make the case for your books, for books that were diverse?
I think the hardest thing for New York was that they didn't have a box for it. You know, back then, any fiction that involved 19th century Black people was, quote unquote, supposed to be revolved around slavery. So here I am with this story of a Oberlin educated Black school teacher, the Buffalo Soldiers, which was the most recognized army unit in the West that people don't know about. And they're living in an all-Black town on the plains of Kansas after the Great Exodus of 1879, which they also didn't know about. And they were like, what are we supposed to do with this? This doesn't fit in any boxes that we have. I got enough rejections to paper my house, your house, and Courtney's. And they loved the writing, but there was always but. And the but was, we don't know anything about Black love. We don't know anything about Black history. So that was my biggest challenge.
And Courtney, many of your earlier books revolved around white characters, and a number of your recent releases have really prominently featured characters of color, including a number of them who have Chinese heritage, which is something you share with them. What changed?
Well, you know, I think a big part of it was me asking questions of myself about what I was writing. I started writing books about white characters because that's what I was reading, and I sort of innately felt like that's what historical romance was. But as time went on and I was writing these stories, and especially as I started drifting towards like the latter half of the 19th century, I started thinking to myself, I'm writing this book that's set in 1870. That is when my great-great-grandparents first left China. Why am I writing about white people when I feel that my heritage contains things that I've learned personally through my family history that no one's writing about and that I think are important and interesting and would make a good story?
It's a common assumption in any form of art, whether it be a movie or book or otherwise, that one of the reasons there aren't a lot of people of color in historical novels is because when you go back through history, the people of color are always suffering. So, Beverly, your books include a lot of African-American history, and they include a lot of joy, struggles too, but joy.
Yeah, that's that very, very narrow lens that history looks at my race with. They think that we get up every morning and we bemoan the fact that we are Black and, you know, struggling, and they leave out the parts about birthday parties and that old couple at church who've been married for 50 years and are still holding hands, walking to the parking lot. All of the things that bring joy to the rest of the world is a joy that we as people of color also celebrate.
I don't want to give the impression that because you two are successful in featuring really a whole host of different races and types of people in your romance novels that we've fixed the problem of representation in the genre. There was a controversy that unfolded with the Romance Writers Association in 2019, Courtney. You were temporarily expelled from the organization because you called out racism within the genre on social media. But earlier the same year, they'd awarded you for promoting diversity within the association. How do you, there's some cognitive dissonance here. How do you make sense of this?
I don't think it makes sense, honestly. I think that, I don't think I could possibly answer that question in 11 hours, let alone 11 minutes. I will just, okay, let me, I think the easiest answer for me to give is this. I think people are afraid of change because when they hear people want representation in romance, they fear, oh, well, that's not my book. So then I will not be as popular. I'll make less money.
Do you think, Beverly, that Bridgerton, the popularity of a show like Bridgerton, strengthens the case for representation within your genre of publishing?
Not if it's just going to be the only one. Hmm. I mean, you have authors of color writing fabulous books, fabulous series, and Bridgerton's the only one that's been, quote-unquote, picked so far. I don't see a lot of press releases about Courtney's stuff being optioned, or, you know, you just got the one. It's the token. So you would hope that it would open the doors, but so far it has not.
So what do you hope for the genre's future when it comes to romance novels? What's your ideal future? Let me begin with you, Courtney.
I would say my ideal future is one in which we see representation on a level that we've never seen before. You know, if you think about the fact that for every Beverly Jenkins we have who has been publishing since 1990, there are how many hundreds of white writers who have been doing the same thing. Just what we have right now in terms of the romance canon is so radically stacked against representation. And I want to also point out that stacking goes not just in terms of race, although this stacks alongside race, but also in terms of where people come from. I have never read a romance novel from Korea. The translation goes one way, from English into other languages, and it almost never comes back. We've had a few instances of books that have gotten translated that have done reasonably well, and I just wish we had more publishers thinking about publishing as a truly global endeavor.
So that is Courtney Milan and Beverly Jenkins, both best-selling authors of historical romance novels. Thanks so much to both of you. Really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for the invite.
The sweeping bill that cleared the Senate yesterday includes a change to the minimum tax levels for corporations. Economists say this could generate hundreds of billions in revenue. Jill Schlesinger is a CBS News business analyst and host of Jill on Money and joins me now to explain. Hi, Jill.
Hello.
Okay, so this bill includes a 15% minimum tax on big corporations. That would be based on their publicly reported profits. How would this work?
So I think a lot of people are like, wait a minute, don't companies have to pay more than that? Yes and no. So yes, it's higher. Remember that we had a 35% corporate tax bracket. That was the highest. And then under the Trump tax cuts, that went down to 21%. But there are a lot of big companies that have a major amount of profits, but they don't pay a lot in taxes. And, you know, these are big names. I'm talking about Amazon or Nike or FedEx. And essentially what they do is they use, it's a loophole, so it's legal. I don't want to make it sound like it's nefarious, but they have used the tax code to avoid paying taxes. Some of them paying less than 6, 5, 4% tax. And so now if you push that back into the tax-paying group, it will raise some money. And I think that the one part of this that some people might not realize is that if you imagine that you had a profit of $1 billion a year, you could still pay 1, 2, or 3%. Yes, you could have under the old rules.
And not surprisingly, many CEOs of corporations are coming forward criticizing this. But I'm reminded that more than 99% of the 28.7 firms in America or so, whatever the number is now, are actually small businesses, and small businesses seem to support it. Why?
Because if you are a small business owner, this fries your onions because you are the person who is paying high taxes. You're the person who doesn't have hundreds of accountants who are figuring out how to avoid paying taxes. And by the way, the vast majority of really small business owners are those people who are using pass-through organizations. And what does that mean? It means, let's say I work for myself. I'm just taxed at whatever my ordinary tax bracket is as an individual, and it passes through for my business income. That means that pretty much all these small business owners, they're paying 22, 24, 32%. And to hear these whining big companies, that's my editorial, say, oh, well, it's so bad, they're making record profits. We've come off of years of record corporate profits. So these big companies are going to have to pony up now. And I think that most small, I'm a former small business owner, so I'm just like, yeah, come on, let's pay some taxes, gang.
So will this have an effect on the average American's tax burden?
No. The big companies are going to say, like, well, now we're going to have to do that. We're going to not hire as much. I doubt that. Every time we've had corporations whine about their high taxes, nothing really happens to the ordinary American. And so I think the vast majority of people are not going to see a big problem. And, you know, just be clear that so much of the tax code is really geared towards people who have a ton of money who can actually use the code to their advantage. For ordinary Americans, there's not much impact here.
Jill Schlesinger, CBS News business analyst and host of Jill on Money. As always, Jill, thank you.
Take care.
It's a space race to the edge of the solar system. That's how one scientist described the nascent plans in the U.S. and separately in China to probe the vast stretches beyond our sun's influence. Some reminders: the heliosphere is the region of space dominated by the sun's magnetic field as it reaches out into space. We on Earth are traveling in that field. The heliopause is the area where the sun loses its influence. On the other side, interstellar space. Now, the Voyager probes were sent to cross over those outer limits of our solar system, but they're spending a lot more time crossing than scientists thought, raising the question, where exactly is the end of our solar system? That's what Ralph McNutt Jr. wants to know. He's chief scientist for space science at the Johns Hopkins University Applied Physics Lab, and he's lobbying NASA to approve plans for a $3 billion interstellar probe that could launch in 2036 if it can escape the yoke of Earth's gravity, not to mention its wary accountants. Oh, and it's a mission that would outlive Ralph. It could last 50 years. Ralph McNutt joins us now. Welcome.
Thank you.
Well, you worked on the Voyager mission, went to Cape Canaveral, but now the hope was that Voyager would continue on into interstellar space, like the space between stars. And your proposal to do this is called the Interstellar Probe, or IP.
Right.
What is it you want to find?
Well, so the Voyagers were actually never designed to last as long as they have. They were actually designed to last 4.5 years. So they're going to be coming up on 45 years this month.
Oh, amazing.
So they've outlived their warranty by a factor of 10, which if you were building cars, you know wouldn't be in good with your bosses right now. But so there are not optimum instruments on board the Voyagers for trying to make some of the measurements that we would really like to make to understand this interaction between our home here in space and the interstellar medium that is out there between us and the other stars. And so the idea with an interstellar probe is to actually take that next big dedicated step and to be able to actually redo all the science that we've been doing before with modern instrumentation and to go as far as we can, at least twice as far as the Voyagers, and go about twice as fast as Voyager 1, which is the fastest thing leaving the solar system.
Well, and it took years. And I'm listening to you. It's like Buzz Lightyear, you know, to infinity and beyond. But, you know, have I got it right that is one of the questions, that the heliopause, this distance before the interstellar space, might be a longer distance than you originally thought?
Exactly how the dynamics work is something that's always been a question. And the other thing we've learned is that Voyager 1 and Voyager 2 went in very different directions, yet they saw the heliopause at about the same distance from the sun. And this was sort of a question of, well, who ordered that? Because that sort of flew in the face of all of the preconceived notions we've all been carrying around for a good 50 years now.
Yeah.
So there's still a lot of mysteries out there about how that our home and space interacts with the interstellar medium. And the idea is to take that next step.
And what does it matter, knowing where the edge of the solar system actually is?
Well, you know, it turns out that there's one heliosphere that that's sometimes called an astrosphere that we know of that is habitable, and that's this one. And we know it's habitable because we're here. And, you know, we've been looking out now for quite a few years and seeing all these exoplanets, planets that are around other stars. And one of the real questions, of course, has been, well, you know, who else might be out there? Are there other civilizations out there? And sort of a piece of the puzzle is trying to understand how that those systems interact with the interstellar medium and what are the implications for life elsewhere in the galaxy. It's also been a question of we've now been around the center of the galaxy about 20 times since the solar system formed. And ever so often we go through other very dense clouds of matter. Dense is still something that would look like a vacuum in a laboratory on the Earth, but it's dense compared to where we are now. And some of these changes in the external environment could affect actually how much radiation exposure has gotten back to the Earth over the eons. And so maybe has something to do with how that we ended up on this planet to begin with.
Well, I'm actually reading in Richard Stone's article in Science recently about your IP proposal that we may learn, and it may be very unsettling, very chilling, we may learn why others have been wiped out, why species have gone extinct. So this is important information that you're going to get. And how you're going to do it, or how you propose to do it, is fascinating.
Well,
to take your probe, whip it around Jupiter for a gravity boost, then slingshot it to the edge of the solar system, but it would take 16 years.
Yeah, well, and that's a short period of time.
Wow. Yeah, faster than Voyager, yeah.
It would take about 6.5 hours to get from the Earth to the moon. And yet, with that kind of a speed, we're still talking about decades to get out to these vast distances that we're talking about here.
Yeah, 50
space
years.
Space is really big.
Oh, I can't wrap. I mean, my head, you know. But here you are. This is your work. How do you wrap your head around a project that's going to be up in space for 50 years, many generations of scientists? Maybe
right.
Not you, ultimately.
Well, I'm definitely going to be dead before the year 2086.
Okay.
I can guarantee that. So, you know, it's the cliche about, well, you have to take the long-term view, right? Well, consider the great cathedrals of Europe. Those were not built in a generation. They were literally built, some of them, over hundreds of years. Future generations will look back to 2022 and go, wow, this is something in the history books. So it's a matter of perspective and being able to kind of jump back and forth. And probably a lot of it has to do with the fact that I used to inhale science fiction novels when I was a kid.
That's right. Well, critics, point to that price tag, that $3.1 billion. Some critics are saying that this would suck all the money out of their coffers and would come at the expense of other work, including studying solar flares that can damage satellites, things like that, climate. First of all, what would you say to those critics? And then would you consider a private company like Blue Origin or SpaceX?
Oh, well, absolutely. I mean, you know, you're always looking for the best deal out there. I mean, ultimately, it's the American taxpayer that's paying for these things. And so, you know, the question always comes up about, well, you know, why are we wasting money on space? But, you know, it's really not wasted because we have learned so much since the beginning of the space program. And you have to keep doing this. You have to keep challenging everybody. You have to keep giving them new challenges. You know, it's like what Kennedy said about, you know, why do we go to the moon? And we do it because it's hard, like Rice playing Texas. And I grew up in Fort Worth, Texas. So, you know, it's all a question of balance. And I think it's worth it because I think that you've got two choices. You can either step backwards or you can step to the future. And you step to the future by doing the new challenges and the new challenging things. And that's how you advance. And you either advance or decline. You don't really have a choice. You can't stand still.
Well, you say, yes, it could, you know, say, where do we come from? But also, where are we going? You could map where the solar system is going. It's, 230 million year orbit around the galaxy.
Right.
But I'm wondering, too, this probe can also, in addition to looking forward, seeing, you know, what's out there, it can turn around and take a picture looking backwards.
Well, that's exactly right.
What would we see? What someone said it's the most expensive snapshot in history, but what is it we would see, it would see?
Actually, there's two answers to the question. So one answer has to do with the fact that the Voyagers have given us a confusing picture of what did this overall interaction between our solar system and the local interstellar medium really looks like. By being able to be outside of the heliosphere and then look back with the so-called neutral energetic atom camera, we would actually be able to see what that the interaction looks like with the rest of space,
wow,
which is something right now that we simply do not know. So that's one thing. That would tell us a lot about ourselves. It would tell us a lot about how other stars also interact with the interstellar medium. And the other thing that we can do is to look back at the Earth and really treat the, as we're going further and further away, to treat the Earth as an exoplanet on the same footing as these other worlds that we don't really know anything about, at least not yet.
Fascinating. Ralph McNutt, Jr., physicist and chief scientist for space science at the Johns Hopkins University Applied Physics Lab. On his proposal, called simply the Interstellar Probe, or IP, to kind of probe outer space where the two Voyager missions left off. Thank you.
Thank you.
And while we wait for Ralph's pictures, maybe 50 years, we've got some images from the Voyager missions at hereandnow.org.
In New York State, officials are urging residents to get vaccinated against polio. Concerns rose after one case was reported last month, and traces of the poliovirus were detected in wastewater in two New York counties north of New York City. Jennifer Nuzzo is professor of epidemiology and director of the Pandemic Center at the Brown University School of Public Health. Dr. Nuzzo, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So the virus was detected in water samples back in June. What does that tell you about whether this disease could and has spread?
Well, the fact that we've found it in water really confirms what we already feared when we found the one case of polio, which is that this virus has likely infected many more, possibly hundreds more. We know that because we found the case of polio in a young person. That person unfortunately experienced paralysis. That is something that happens one in 200 cases, one in 100 cases sometimes. And so what that means is that there are many more people likely infected with this virus. And that suspicion was confirmed with finding it in the wastewater.
That person was unvaccinated, and the particular area where they lived is well known for a lot of vaccine hesitancy, vaccine resistance. How effective is the polio vaccine?
Well, the polio vaccine, particularly the one we use here in the United States, if you're fully vaccinated, it's not really something that you have to worry about contracting. But we very much worry about people who have not been vaccinated, particularly children living in the area, because they are now potentially being exposed to this virus. And as we've seen, the virus has the ability to cause paralysis, which is a really terrible outcome. So we very much worry about people who are not vaccinated. And had communities been fully up to date in their vaccines, we likely wouldn't be seeing this sort of thing happening now.
And the counties we're talking about, north of New York City, Rockland and Orange, only about 60% of two-year-olds are vaccinated there. Is that enough to achieve herd immunity?
No, it's not enough. And, you know, this is not just a problem limited to those counties. This is something that we're seeing worldwide now where vaccine coverage is not what it needs to be. Some of this was because of vaccinations being put on hold due to the pandemic, but some of it is because parents, you know, unfortunately are not convinced of the benefits of vaccines. My hope is that seeing this very serious outcome will cause some to change their minds and get their children vaccinated. But it's absolutely urgent that we focus our efforts on making sure that happens.
So you said in a tweet that it's not surprising that we're hearing about another emerging disease while still dealing with COVID-19. You said serious infectious disease threats are the hazards of our time. What do you mean?
Well, you know, for many years, people have been saying to me, it seems like there's always some new disease. We just keep hearing about these things more and more. And the reality is they are. All the data that we have suggests that the frequency with which new diseases are emerging and causing serious outbreaks are increasing. So that's why we're going to see things like COVID-19, the virus that causes COVID-19. We're going to hear about things like that more frequently. At the same time, global conditions are making us more susceptible to viruses that we didn't used to worry about, declining vaccinations, making polio once again a concern. We're also dealing with monkeypox here in this country. Many countries that weren't previously areas that monkeypox was endemic now dealing with monkeypox. And that's just a condition of global travel, increased susceptibility, and also limiting our attention for the last few years, just focusing on one virus and not paying attention to the smaller events that have happened. So these sorts of things are going to keep happening, and we have to make sure we have systems in place to deal with them. It's incredibly challenging right now for health officials who have been understaffed for far too long, under-resourced, coming out of a very stressful COVID-19 pandemic, dealing with monkeypox, and now also having to think about polio possibly circulating. So we need to make sure we have enough resources in place that we can respond to possibly multiple emergencies at a time in hopes that they don't get out of control.
You mentioned that not only is COVID-19 still rampant, but also monkeypox has appeared in the U.S. and now polio. Is it possible to prioritize those for you in terms of concern? Can you sort of triage which is the biggest worry?
Well, I mean, COVID-19 still represents a deep concern, but fortunately we have vaccines and diagnostics and tools. What we need to make sure is that everyone avails themselves of those. So the level of concern for COVID is not the same as it was 2 years ago. Polio is a deep concern for communities that are not vaccinated, highly vaccinated, and so that remains an ongoing concern. Monkeypox is quite worrisome to me because, you know, it really was a virus that we should have been able to contain much more quickly than we have, and people are suffering a great deal of pain when they contract the virus. Fortunately, it hasn't killed many people yet, but we shouldn't wait for more deaths, so we should act. So I would say that they're all important, but the level of concern I have for them is quite different.
Jennifer Nuzzo is professor of epidemiology and director of the Pandemic Center at the Brown University School of Public Health. Doctor, thank you so much.
Thanks so much.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Celeste Headlee in Washington, D.C.
I'm Robin Young in Boston. It's Here and Now.